the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is going to be Jonathan Clements from the Wall Street Journal. Four strategies for avoiding penny pinching in retirement, if you're close to retirement right now, and also avoiding that lower lifestyle. You know, this week, a lot of students, and probably last week, have been graduating around the country from high school and college. Time to talk about college as being probably one of the biggest bills that parents are going to have to pay for their kids next to buying a new home. Public school averages $18,000 to $20,000 a year as far as education. Private college, $40,000 to $50,000 a year. One child alone can cost a fortune. Now, there are ways around this if you know what you're doing. If you have multiple children, it can wreak havoc with your retirement plans. So we're going to try to simplify this whole process. The decisions you make not only impact your children, but your own retirement as well. And what you want to do is to strike a balance between the goals for educating your children and your own retirement, short of throwing the children out on the street and telling them they're on their own at age four. Okay. So anyway, let's tackle this one, Jim.
You mentioned something there, John, but usually both goals, whether it's educating our kids or providing for our own retirement, have consequences today. I mean, we've all seen studies about education costs have skyrocketed over the last three decades. Gosh, I can remember, John, when I started, I spent 2 years in getting an AA degree at a junior college. My tuition was $45 a semester. I got my AA degree for $180. I mean, can you imagine what $180 would buy you today? Probably just one textbook. But anyway, you take a look at these education costs today, and I don't care if you're looking at, let's say, public education, or furthermore, if you're looking at private, it's almost become the equivalent of purchasing a home. So we have the cost of education is one issue that parents face. Then we also have the issue of retirement itself, because we've talked and done a number of shows here. People are living longer thanks to advances in medicine today. And also the retirement market is much different today. You're not only living longer, you're having to wait further to get your first Social Security check and get full benefits. We're looking at the lowest interest rates that we've seen in centuries. And there's a study that was done recently that 50% of Americans will see a drop in their living standards once they enter into retirement. Oftentimes, you know, as I mentioned, most parents today, when they get hit with these sort of conflicting goals, gosh, we want to plan for our retirement. We're not feeling really secure about it. But we also have kids that we want to give them a head start in life and make sure they get educated. And there's a conflict. So depending on the needs, you have to prioritize. And that's what I want to cover today on the show, is making education less costly.
Well, now I imagine that the best option today is to, ta-da-da, you guessed it, start early. When you're coming home from the hospital, begin your investment plans, all right? And it's obvious the sooner you put money away, the longer period that you have, not only does that give you more time to earn the money and less of an impact on your pocketbook, you're compounding that money and making more dollars available when your son or daughter actually starts college. So I imagine that the investment choices can really make a difference here in how well you're going to compound your money.
Yeah, I mean, today, when we talk about education, you're basically talking about funding 4 years at a school. And let's just say that you're going to go to a state school to keep the cost down. Because what are the costs? I think the national average is somewhere between $18,000 and $20,000 for a public education per year, and somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000 for private. Now, if you take that $18,000 to $20,000, assuming that you stop home from the hospital once a junior is born at your financial advisor, starting from day one, John, if you would want to cover those costs, you would probably have to put aside probably anywhere from $150 to $175 a month over an 18-year period to have enough money. And that's assuming a rate of return of 6 to 8%. I'm not using the 10% returns for historical stock markets because I just don't think we're in that kind of a market. you can actually double that amount if you're thinking of a private school, and that's per child. So if you have a long enough period to invest, you're obviously going to be better off investing in, let's say, a stock mutual fund where you're dollar cost averaging on a monthly basis. And really all you care is when junior starts college is how many shares of those funds that you own. So the earlier you get started, it's just like anything else, even with your own retirement, the better off you're going to be. But John, it's just not about putting dollars aside. It's also about making the right investment choices. It's important that you put money aside, you make the right investment choices, but you also want to do so on a tax-efficient manner, because the tax laws have skewed, unless you're using certain vehicles, taxation with children. Because back in the old days, I can remember when we tried to get money over to children and they had the money taxed in the child's tax bracket. Well, they got wise to that, and depending on what your child earns in interest and dividends, once they reach a certain level, it's like $1,500, $1,700, it's taxed back to you. So you want to do this on a tax-efficient manner and also a financial aid efficiency manner too, because your son or daughter has too much money in their name, it actually cuts back on their ability to get grants. So you have savings issue, you have investment issues, you have tax efficiency issues, and you also have financial aid issues. There's really four components that come into play here when it comes to talking about financing a college education.
Well, I know you've discussed various ways to do that, from zero coupon municipal bonds, 529 plans, to other tax-free and deferral methods. What do you usually recommend? Do you have a standard procedure?
Well, you know, a lot of that's going to depend, John, on the financial aid considerations, the tax bracket of the parents, and the type of school funding. Are you funding for, you know, is junior going to go to college at Harvard or Stanford, or are they going to go to, let's say, UCLA? But, you know, when it comes to funding for college, you know, my favorites for tax efficiency is really zero coupon tax-free bonds, or let's say 529 plans, because that way you don't have to worry about the taxability of capital gains, interest, or dividends.
Well, let's discuss particulars of 529 plans. I mean, according to studies, they are underutilized, but they're popular by the many families that do use them.
Well, one of the reasons they become popular is they have what I would call seven distinct advantages. Number one is 529 plans offer unsurpassed income tax breaks. Although you do not get a tax deduction for contributing to a 529 plan, the assets that are in the 529 plan grow federal tax-free and will not be taxed when the money is taken out, as long as it's used to pay for college. The tax treatment was made permanent with the Pension Protection Act of 2006. Now, the president wanted to do away with that in a State of the Union speech, but it was made permanent going back to law that was passed in 2006. So the first advantage of a 529 plan is the unsurpassed income tax breaks. A second advantage, and you're going to really have to look up your state, but your own state may offer you a tax break as well. There are 34 states, including the District of Columbia, that currently offer residents a full or partial tax deduction or credit for 529 plans. So you don't get a tax deduction or credit on the federal side, but on the state side, you could get a tax deduction. So a state tax break would be the second advantage. The third advantage is you, the donor, stay in control of the account. And this is in contrast to the Uniform Gift to Minors Act. The named beneficiary has no legal rights. So if you name Junior as the beneficiary, Junior doesn't have a legal right to the funds. So you can assume the money will be used for the intended purpose that you want it to be used for, in this case, being an education. So you control the account is a third advantage. A fourth advantage is low maintenance. 529 plans are very hands-off way to save for college. There are a lot of plan websites. It's sort of a set it and forget it automatic investment program, kind of like dollar cost averaging. So low maintenance, they're very easy to operate. That's a fourth advantage. A fifth advantage is simplified tax reporting. You do not have to report anything in a 529 plan on your federal tax return. In other words, if there's interest, dividends, or capital gains in the mutual funds in the account, you're not going to get a 1099. However, you got to be careful when you're making contributions to a 529 plan, you don't exceed the gift tax limits of $14,000 per individual, $28,000 if you're a husband and wife. There are some acceleration clauses we'll get to later on, but very simplified tax reporting would probably be a fifth benefit. The sixth benefit is flexibility. You can change your 529 investment options twice a year. You can roll over your funds into another 529 plan, just as you can roll over, for example, IRA rollovers, so you have some flexibility. And the seventh advantage is, unlike a lot of the other popular savings programs like the Coverdell Education Accounts or Roth IRAs, is everybody is eligible for a 529 plan. They don't exclude you if you make a certain level of income or you have a certain amount of assets. So there's probably seven advantages of these 529 plans, which is what has made them very, very popular. And that's why when the president first talked about trying to get rid of the tax-free status, there was such a backlash, they quickly retracted that one.
Yeah, caused a lot of hoopla on that one. Okay, those sound like the good aspects of the 529 plan, especially the tax-free advantage. Any negatives in these?
Yeah, there is some negatives. And I mentioned in terms of convenience, there's less flexibility in terms of investment asset changes. You can only change the asset mix of a 529 plan twice a year. Now, I've heard talk that they're going to try to change that and maybe, I don't know, increase it to six times a year. But let's say that you're very bullish on the stock market, like let's say in 2012, 2013, the stock market's going up. And then all of a sudden we get into the taper tantrum in the middle of 2013 and you say, oh my goodness, I want to change right now. You can only do that twice a year. So they're less flexible. The other thing too is, even though they're tax free, it's only tax free if you use it for education. If you take the money out and decide, Junior's not going to college, he's going into the Army or in the Navy, I don't need that, you take out that money, it's subject to not only income taxes on accumulated gains, but also a 10% federal tax penalty. This applies for non-qualified withdrawals. And in some cases, on the financial aid front, if you have substantial amounts in 529 plans, depending on how you title who the owner is the kid the owner, junior the owner, are you the owner, or grandparents the owner, it can impact financial aid, especially if you have it in the student's name.
Okay, well, now we've discussed the best way to save for college is to start early, as soon as the kids are born, make good investment choices such as stocks and stock mutual funds. And you want to do this on a tax-efficient basis, because the more money you maintain in your little system, rather than paying it out to Uncle Sam, the better off you're going to be. It compounds and you'll have more money available. Something else we haven't looked at so far.
Well, I mean, this really takes a lot of forethought and planning when you're looking at this, because for most families with children, the parents have two goals. They're going to have to save for their own retirement, unless you work for the government and you're going to get a guaranteed pension. Most people working in the private sector today have 401k programs. They don't have guaranteed pension plans anymore. So you're going to have to look at your budget. What realistically can we afford to put aside for our kids' education, at the same time fund our own retirement? And John, we hate to say this over and over again, but it begins with a budget, because only looking at your budget and say, all right, we've got to find a balance here. So you got to find out, what amount of money do you have available to fund both retirement and education? Then also you have to determine realistic goals based on the number of kids that you have. And what are you going to try to fund for? You're going to try to fund for a public education, which is roughly $20,000 a year. Let's say that's $80,000. Or private education, which is $40,000, or double that amount, which is $160,000. Then you also have to take a look at your current age. How many years away are you from retirement or full Social Security benefits? And obviously, if you start early, you have time in compounding working in your favor. As I mentioned earlier, to fund for, let's say, $80,000 four-year state college, that's roughly going to be anywhere from $150 to $175 a month, depending on how early and what kind of investments. And then you also have to take a look at, all right, I'm going to fund for my kids' education, but I also need to be putting money aside and have time and compounding work in favor for me for my own retirement. Because as we discovered and talked about last week, and I'll talk with Jonathan Clements from the Wall Street Journal coming up, there's a new study that's out that's saying that 50% of Americans will actually experience a lower standard of living in retirement. So you also want to not only just save, you want to have priorities. How much is going to go to education? How much are we going to use to fund our retirement? That can obviously change as your income increases or as time passes by. But also you want to use the appropriate investments, and you also want to make sure you're doing it on a tax-efficient manner.
You know, I know you're a big proponent of what you call the 2+2 plan and work, but perhaps we should revisit that plan, because there have been a number of stories recently, both in the Wall Street Journal and in Bloomberg, about millennials and Gen Xers who are just really saddled with debt, which I found astounding, especially those who come out of college with unbelievable amounts of debt, as well as baby boomers heading into retirement with a minimal amount of planning or with more debt than their parents.
You know, I think a lot of this, John, could probably be resolved with, I think we need to see a major paradigm shift in the thinking about college, as we're starting to see when it comes to retirement. Education costs, there's no secret, have skyrocketed, in many instances are really out of control, if not out of reach, for a lot of parents today. I mean, you think about it, even a state school of $18,000 to $20,000 a year, I mean, that's $80,000. Think of a family that has three kids, you're talking about $240,000 or $250,000 just to educate three children. And for most Americans, one of the reasons that we've seen this is there really hasn't been a lot of competition when it comes to education. It's basically a government monopoly. And as we know, monopolies have full pricing. And that's what we've seen. In addition to that, there's a lot more uncertainties today that parents face, especially when it comes to regarding their own retirement. You know, gone are the defined benefit pension plans. They've basically disappeared. Gone are high interest rates. Gone are high returns in financial assets. And, you know, there's a lot more economic uncertainty here. And those are two very vexing problems, rising education costs and greater uncertainty regarding one's own retirement. So obviously, if you start early and you have the discipline to save, that's usually not going to be an issue. But unfortunately, John, it hits most Americans when they're in their late 40s and early 50s, and all of a sudden they're waking up to, oh my goodness, I'm only 10, 15 years away from retirement. I don't have the money that I thought I was going to have. And we've got two or three kids coming up here on college. One wants to go to Stanford. One wants to go to, let's say, a state school. What do you do? And it hits you at a real key period of time, hopefully when parents are at their peak earning cycle in their working career.
All right, so how are you going to sort this out into a series that you can manage, like prioritization?
You know, one of the things that I'm a big proponent of is what I call the 2+2 plan, or the work in online program. I mean, you need to set a goal for each kid. And the thing that I like about the 2+2 plan is you could send your child to a junior college for the first 2 years, where you're probably going to get by between, let's say, $2,000 and $3,000. So you take 2 years, that's anywhere from, let's say, $4,000 to $6,000, and then 2 years at a state college. And the other thing is this idea of sending junior off to school, you're paying for room and board, which also drives that cost up. You know, what if your son or daughter goes to a junior college, stays at home and works part-time and helps you fund their education expenses? So if you take a look at breaking down the education costs and say, look, given the number of kids we have, our ability to save, we're only going to fund for, let's say, a state school. And we're also going to break that up into 2 years at a junior college to bring down that cost, 2 years at a state college. And you can dramatically cut the cost of college down to, let's say, $40,000 or $50,000 versus the $80,000 or more. And you can cut that cost down, especially the first couple of years. You can cut that cost by 80%, even more, if your son or daughter stays at home and works. And if junior works, you can save even more money junior could start to help saving and putting money aside to cover those 2 years when, let's say, your son or daughter is going to be attending a state school. So it not only is great for the parents, but it's also for the kids, because, John, one of the problems that we have with millennials and Gen Xers is the enormous amount of trillions of dollars of student debt, where the average husband and wife getting married, they start a marriage off with $70,000, $80,000 of student loans. The 2+2 plan minimizes the amount of debt that junior or your son and daughter will have coming out of college. Imagine coming out of college debt-free with no debt. Imagine what life would look like starting out as a family. And also imagine parents if they didn't have to fund $80,000 or $160,000 per kid, if they can cut that down dramatically. Sometimes I've seen it done for as low as $20,000. I've got a family right now, even though they could afford to send their kids, they said, hey, look, you're going to go to junior college the first 2 years. You're going to go to state school. You're going to live at home unless they're providing for moving away from home. Let's say when you go to a state school. But I've got a family right now that basically told their kids, this is what we're going to cover. You're going to junior college. You're staying at home first 2 years. When you get to your state school, we'll pay for that and you go away. But we also want you to work. There's nothing wrong. I've never seen a child harmed by the fact that they had to learn to save and work.
Well, what about online colleges now? This is becoming a more effective method for people who maybe need to interact with the rest of their life. There's night school plus working at the same time. There are online degrees, which are starting to proliferate. So we're seeing even more major universities offer some kind of online courses, online degrees, from bachelor's to, say, an MBA program.
Well, this is another approach that I think is going to be part of this new paradigm shift that we're going to see take place in education. And that is getting work experience, which can actually, in many cases, alter one's career decision. You may decide, I know this had a major effect on two of my own sons. More importantly, when you work in online, there's a lot more alternatives. Working, let's say you have a day job and you go to night school online. I know I have a daughter-in-law that is an engineer that worked for a defense contractor during the day, and at night, over a year and a half, went and got her MBA in engineering management. So there's nothing wrong with working and attending online programs. It's cheaper. In many cases, in her case, the cost of the education was picked up by the company. So that's another way of avoiding student loans, student debts, and of course, my 2+2 program. Now, the nice thing about these things is they don't stress the budget as much. It enables more dollars that can put away for retirement. For example, taking advantage of your 401k program. And secondly, it means junior, in many cases, graduates from college without the heavy burden of student loans to start out their working career or their marriage, as this problem has beset so many that we see of Gen Xers and millennials. So it's a win-win, John, both for mom and dad and their kids. I mean, the present system really is broken. It really doesn't work. There's very few families that can really afford the cost of a private education today, unless you're fortunate enough. One of my brother's daughter just got a athletic scholarship to a college. So that was one way that alleviated some of the cost for him. So unless you've got an all-star athlete in the family or a genius in the family that you're going to rely on scholarships, I think this is more practical for most of what I call middle-income Americans that are looking at the twin goals of not only educating their children, giving them a good education, but not overburdening themselves or their children with debt, and at the same time trying to achieve their own retirement goals.
Well, in our case, we did a mix. We sort of, to use a pun, we diversified how we handled different things. First of all of our kids went to a junior college locally and stayed at home while they were going there. In some cases, there may have been some work. I'm trying hard to remember that. We were able to put together tuitions by combining scholarships or other forms of grants. And as a result of that, and then combining some small amounts of loans in there. But I think if I had to do it for all of the children that we had, which are three, we were able to do the loans for under $20,000 all told. And a lot of those are already paid off. So we've been able to do that. And then, of course, my youngest graduate work has all been funded by college work that he's doing.
Yeah, I know in my own case with, let's say, my middle son, Chris, I mean, he started out more in the scientific realm. Originally, he wanted to be a vet, you know, and one of the things I suggested to him, why don't you try to get a part-time job during the summer working for a veterinarian? And that's what he did. He got a job working for our pet's vet. And it only took a couple summers working at a veterinarian shop and getting bit a couple times. Watch those pit bulls, guys, that said, I don't know if I want to do this. And so the next thing, he was still leaning more towards science, and he worked in a research lab at Pfizer, which eventually led to him getting a biochemistry degree. But then, you know, out of school, he took a test. He wasn't really happy with what he was doing. And he tested his aptitude was basically law and finance. So we basically sent him back to a junior college for a semester where he took accounting and economics to see if he liked it, and then began the CFA program. But with all our children, we used the 2+2 program, even though we could afford to go and send our kids to, let's say, a private institution. We wanted them to learn the work ethic. We made them work ever since they got out of eighth grade. We taught them to save and work, and they had to contribute. And John, we did the same thing. While they were attending junior college, they were living at home, which kept the cost down. And, you know, the great thing about it is they all left college. None of them had any student loans, especially now that all three of them are married. So, you know, I admit I'm probably partially biased towards junior colleges, but so are companies today. They're coming up with degree programs and work specialization programs. Kind of reminds me of the 14th century guilds that they're working with junior colleges. But like I said, I got a 2-year degree, and then I went on to Arizona State. You know, my certificate from Arizona State is a Bachelor of Science. It doesn't say a half Bachelor of Science. So your degree will be from the school that you finally graduate from. So, you know, there's just no way. I don't know about you, John. I came from a large family. My parents just didn't have the money to send us kids to college. So we had no choice but to work our way through college. And I think that's a good thing for many families and children.
Yeah, in my case, I was able to do it by means of, when it came to working, we had a small loan, and then I worked at radio stations. So for a lot of the undergraduate work, I was going to college during the day and running a classical radio show at night, you know, and if you just pick the right selections, you pick the longest Beethoven, Mozart, you know, whatever you put in there, you can get a lot of reading done while the record's playing, you know, no big deal for 6 hours a night or whatever it was. So that worked out. But, you know, after about 4 years, I got tired of that. It was an 18-hour-a-day proposition, but it worked. You know, I was able to make it all work. And when you're young, you can take a lot of abuse. then you hit this level where I don't want to do this anymore. Let me go do something else. So, you know, it does seem like some kind of a paradigm shift is called for, because educational costs keep rising and becoming less affordable. Some of that, ironically, has been driven by government policies as far as loans, you know. And as soon as the loans became available, then we began to see the rise in education. And the real question is, do the colleges really have to charge as much as they do? The other issue is people living longer. So if you're trying to plan for this, you know, you're trying to plan for a longer retirement on one side and to get your kids through education on the other side, and you can find yourself straddled between these two areas. So most couples have to deal with these issues. They have to educate their kids and plan for their own retirement. That's what it looks like to me anyway, from some of the case studies we've done on the program. And in the realities of today's economy, this is going to be even more critical, because what's going to play more important role in the future, both in getting a college degree and in retirement, is to take all of this and somehow come up with a strategy to work it all through.
You know, the paradigm shift that we've talked about here is already taking place when it comes to retirement. I don't think it's taken place yet in the education field. We talked last week about this extensive survey that was done by Bankers Life about boomers heading into retirement. A couple of things that came out of that survey: boomers are working longer, or they're incorporating some form of work in their retirement plans. What I think needs to happen now, John, and we're not seeing it yet, the shift needs to take place at the education level. Because unless you're, for example, Larry Lotsabucks, you know, I think the 2+2 plan or work and online make a lot more sense, because number one, it frees up mom and dad to salt away more money for their own retirement, because you're going to need it. And junior doesn't leave college with a heavy debt burden. Did you think your kids were worse off because they went to a junior college and they had to have a job and work? You know, it teaches them responsibility, and it gives them a stake in their own education when they're helping to fund and pay for part of it. And not only that, as we've seen in retirement now, there's been a number of studies that we've seen come out over the last couple of years that people actually work part-time or work longer, live longer, they're more productive. So I just don't think incorporating work into an education plan, but there needs to be a paradigm shift when it comes to thinking on funding education. It's just gotten to be too expensive. And I've seen too many mistakes made by individuals where they put mortgages on their homes, they've sold off assets to pay for education. It's all great, but then they find themselves panicking because they're getting closer to retirement, and especially something that happens unexpectedly, like a health issue starts to crop up, or what we saw in the financial crisis, all of a sudden you're laid off. You thought you were going to work to age 66. Instead, you get laid off at age 60. Now what do?
You start a radio show.
Okay.
It works. You know, anyway. So other than that, if things were to work ideally, you want to start early. You know, maybe the day your kids come home from the hospital or for home delivery, the day that they're born, you want to save regularly. Now, just saving doesn't necessarily do it. You know, in these low interest rate environments, a savings account will probably not do much for you. So you have to invest appropriately in assets such as stocks and plan tax efficiently, like using a 529. Plan. All of these things working together and keeping an eye on what's going on in the investment will get you retired and get your kids through college. And in addition to that, you have to realize that you do have 15 years from the time they're born until you have to actually start paying on some college tuitions. We agreed that a 2+2 plan is a good goal. But the one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to have to mortgage the kids to mortgage the house in order to. That's not a bad idea. Mortgage the kids. I have to think about that. Anyway.
Oh, by the way, can you imagine that? You know, they get out of college. I forgot to tell you, when you were born, we put a mortgage on you.
You don't want to have to mortgage the house to put your kids through school. So these are some of the things that you have to do. But you also need to think about your own 401k contributions as well towards your own retirement. Now, we're going to move on to our case study, which we always do here on the program. This is a real-life study with which we are directly familiar, and we've changed the names to protect the privacy of the people involved, but it is a true-life study.
This week is the case study, Gary and Kathy Simmons. Basically, Gary was in marketing management for one of the biotech companies here, and Kathy was a paralegal. Gary and Kathy were referred to us by Kathy's parents, who are a client of ours. Basically, they were in the early 40s for Gary. They had three children, two girls and one boy, ages 3, 6, and 8. Their combined income was roughly about $140,000 a year. They had a nice home, $750,000 mortgage on it. Obviously, with California taxes, property taxes, mortgage payments, they were both contributing to their 401ks, but they weren't maximizing. They were putting roughly out of that $140,000, they were putting about $1,000 a month between them, about $12,000 a year into their 401k plan. The parents were emphasizing, look, you guys need to have a plan here. We're willing to work with you on the kids' education, but we need to see a plan. You've got three kids. And obviously, you know, this had been a topic that Kathy had discussed with her parents, especially after having three children and having gone back to work. So there were a number of things here. They had retirement goals, and especially in Gary's case, they really didn't have anything other than a 401k program and some stock options. Obviously, if the company had some breakthrough drugs, that could be significant down the road. But, you know, once again, that's iffy. You can't say, hey, I can count on that. You don't know what that's going to be. Now, the good news here was Gary, who was in marketing management, was due for a promotion. And that promotion could be anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000 more a year in salary, not to mention more stock option grants. And really, when you're working for a biotech company, you make the next best drug discovery, you discover a cure for cancer or something like that, that can be a significant goal towards meeting financial requirements down the road, whether it's education or retirement. But right now, we couldn't count on that.
Well, it sounds like they were just barely making enough here to drive a 401k plan. But, oh, you know what we forgot to do? We forgot to mention their ages, too.
Gary was age 42. Kathy was 37.
So this seems like a rescue situation.
Well, it really wasn't a rescue. It was really one of planning. And, you know, Kathy's parents said they're willing to kick in and help. And we suggested using 529 plans, which would create tax-free income for college, because obviously you don't want to have dividends and interest taxed back to the parents. So Kathy's parents were willing to put some money in. They were willing to put in $10,000 a year in gifting for all three children. And they also wanted to see Gary and Kathy contribute some too. They're saying, hey, we're going to help. We'd like to see you guys do some of this as well. So basically, I had suggested a 529 plan. And of the $10,000, I suggested basically $5,000 go to their oldest daughter, Jennifer. She was the 8-year-old. $4,000 go to Natalie because she was 6. And then John, only $1,000 because John, you know, that was the newborn. And so he was the youngest in the family. And then I suggested that perhaps they take their own contributions and break it out in a similar fashion, because John, being younger, had 15 years more before he would be eligible to attend college. And the other thing that we both agreed on, along with Kathy's parents, is the 2+2 plan. You know, as long as the three kids were starting out in college, Jennifer would start out at a junior college, unless she got a scholarship, live at home the first 2 years. So they subscribed to the idea of a 2+2 plan, basically 2 years at a junior college, 2 years at a state school. So the idea was, especially if Gary got his promotion, that would free up some money that they could start, both Kathy and Gary, start maximizing their own 401k plan, because they really didn't have a lot of retirement assets built up. A lot of it went to down payment, buying homes, furniture, buying the house, the cars, sending kids to school. So they were already spending a lot of money there already. So the 2+2 plan made a lot of sense. And that could alter and make it possible, especially as Gary was due for a promotion. He was pretty assured that. So I recommended that they start, if that promotion take place, maximize their 401k plan, because the fact that Kathy's parents were willing to contribute 10 grand a year was already a head start, because Jennifer, the oldest, still had almost 10 years to fund for a college education. And as long as Jennifer started with the junior college, she could stay at home and the tuition costs would be much more manageable. So that's basically, John, how we altered the plans for this couple in their thinking in the new education paradigm, because we really wanted to make sure that they would also be funding their own program, because Gary was working for a biotech firm. I mean, they could live and die based on FDA approval, the success or failure of the drugs that they were trying to invent. I mean, if they come up with successful drug programs, they get bought out, or they invent a cure for cancer, I mean, those stock options could be worth a fortune. But like any kind of industry, technology, biotechnology, very high risk. So we wanted to have a plan that was workable. I mean, we could always alter that. If he gets a job, the company becomes successful, stock options, well, we could change from, let's say, 2+2 plan to maybe even private education. But basically, this is how we changed the paradigm to meet both the objectives of saving for retirement, but at the same time, making sure that the three kids got a college education.
And once again, another successful life story, a problem and a problem solved to a successful conclusion. Coming up next, Jonathan Clements from the Wall Street Journal, 4 strategies for avoiding penny pinching and a lower lifestyle when you get into retirement. All of this coming up as Lifetime Income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income specialists, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, for many Americans, it was a date they always dreamed about: retirement. For some, that time has come early, sometimes not at their own choosing. In others, retirement is turning out much different than they planned. The interest rates aren't where they thought they would be, nor do they have the assets at levels they thought they would be when they were planning for retirement. More Americans are finding themselves pinching their way throughout retirement. doesn't always have to be that way. Joining me on the program is Jonathan Clements from the Wall Street Journal. And Jonathan, let's talk about, there was a survey done by the National Retirement Risk Index, which was created by Boston's College, and they said 52% of households will see their standard of living fall if they opt to retire at age 65, and that percentage is up 30% from 30% in 1989. What's driving those percentages up?
A couple of things are going on. One, we've seen the demise of the traditional company pension. You go back 30 years, and a lot of people still had these traditional company pensions. It essentially took responsibility away from the individual. You didn't have to worry about how you were investing the money. You didn't have to worry about saving. But, of course, as we know, over the last three decades, those traditional company pensions have been replaced by 401k plans, and suddenly the responsibility for saving and investing has been firmly put into the hands of the employee, and many of them have faced up to that responsibility and failed miserably. Unfortunately, a lot of people just aren't saving enough for retirement, and they aren't investing intelligently. Another thing that you need to know about that Boston College statistic is it is based on people retiring at age 65, but the reality is quite different. When you survey people, they do indeed say they expect to retire at age 65, but on average, the typical American retires at age 62, which is 3 years earlier, and that makes a big difference because that's 3 years less when you're going to get to save and invest and earn investment returns, but also means you have to draw down your assets in retirement for 3 years more.
And, you know, something that has changed, I know what it is for, let's say, somebody like myself, where full retirement age is 66, and for some it's going to be age 67. Jonathan, let's also talk about those that retire early without full retirement benefits are not really getting the full benefits of Social Security, which could have a major impact on their retirement income.
If you look at the stats, roughly half of people retiring each year claim Social Security at age 62, which is the earliest possible age. And if you do that, if you claim Social Security at age 62, what you discover is that you're giving up a huge potential benefit. Social Security is the best retirement income that most of us will receive. And there are multiple reasons for this. One, it's government guaranteed. Two, it rises every year with inflation. Three, you know you're going to get it for as long as you live. And four, it's at least partially tax-free. And five, when you die, your spouse may receive your benefit as a survivor benefit. For all of those reasons, you should probably think about delaying Social Security until at least age 66 or age 67, and possibly, if you're the main breadwinner, until age 70. By delaying until age 70, you get a monthly benefit in inflation-adjusted terms that's either 76 or 77% larger. So to the extent that people can, I would encourage them to delay claiming Social Security.
Yeah, you know, the other thing, too, that we're seeing, I mean, it's a product of the financial crisis. But, Jonathan, I can remember in the year 2000, if you said I wanted $3,000 a month safe monthly income, it only took $500,000 in two-year treasury bills, and I could get you $3,000 a month in something that was very, very secure. Today, you're talking multiple millions of that number to get the same level of income.
One of the things that I'm sure you talked about on the program and a lot of financial planners talk about is this 4% withdrawal rate. And what that 4% withdrawal rate is, you withdraw 4% of your retirement assets in the first year of retirement, and thereafter you step up your withdrawals along with inflation. Well, do the math on that today. Right now, if you go out and you buy 10-year treasury notes, you're getting a yield that roughly corresponds to the expected inflation rate. So what does that mean? If you opt for that 4% withdrawal rate with stepping up your withdrawals every year with inflation and you put everything into 10-year treasuries, your retirement assets will last 25 years. After 25 years, you will be out of money. And there's a good chance if you're retiring at 62 or 65 that either you or if you're married, your spouse will actually live past age 90. So going the low-risk route, putting everything into government bonds, which was something you probably could have done 20 or 30 years ago, is not a safe strategy today. It may appear safe, but it isn't because there's a very real risk that you could run out of money.
So given the fact that there are a number of things that seem to be conspiring or a confluence of different events, we know that, for example, through health technology, medical advancements, people are living longer, so life expectancies have increased. We've seen falling bond yields, as you just mentioned, and also, as you talked about at the beginning, the disappearance of these traditional defined benefit pension plans, and then also the raising of Social Security age, and with many individuals, let's say, haven't been laid off during the financial crisis, starting their benefits earlier. So given the fact of these type of events, let's say you are an individual that is getting close to retirement today. What are some strategies that are workable that can make sure you're less likely to run out or outlive your assets?
Well, one of the things that you might want to think about doing is ensuring that you have a healthy stream of income that is guaranteed for life. And the best stream of guaranteed lifetime income you can get, as I've already mentioned, which is Social Security. But, you know, Social Security alone may not be enough to cover your expenses in retirement. So what should you do next? Well, I'm a fan, and I think I'm probably in a distinct minority, but I'm a fan of using income annuities to supplement what you receive from Social Security. What you do when you buy an income annuity is essentially you get in a risk pool with a whole bunch of other retirees, you put your money together, and those who die early in retirement don't get very much money back from the pool, but people who live a long time will receive a healthy stream of income for as long as they live. So if you think about that proposition, okay, you know, we're going to pool risk, we're going to get this lifetime stream of income, what sort of annuity should I buy? And I'm a fan of keeping things simple, so probably my first choice would be to go out and just buy a plain vanilla immediate fixed annuity that's going to pay you lifetime income. You know, you don't want any of the bells and whistles, you know, some sort of, you know, guaranteed return of principal to your heirs. You don't want sort of guaranteed payments for any minimum number of years. Just decide how much you're willing to put into this immediate fixed annuity. Plunk the money in there, go for the maximum income you can by avoiding the bells and whistles, and, you know, with any luck, you'll live, you know, long and prosperous retirement, and if you don't live long and you die before you get much money back from the income annuity, as I like to tell people, it's a decision you're not going to live to regret.
You know, the other thing, Jonathan, really, essentially, when you go out and buy an immediate annuity, it's no different than what was occurring when we had defined benefit pension plans, because companies put X aside each year for their employees. When the employee got to retirement age, they had a pool of money set aside. They went to an insurance company, said, you know, this employee is age 65, his spouse is this. What will you give this employee for that amount of money? You're essentially creating your own defined benefit pension plan.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things that I say to people is, you know, one of these sort of extraordinary pieces of irrationality you see today is the people, you know, who are at companies that still have traditional pensions, they will stay in a job that they hate for 30 years in order to get that traditional company pension. But when they get to retirement and they want additional lifetime income, you can't get them to buy an immediate annuity with their savings. It doesn't make any sense at all. When you sign up for a company with a traditional pension plan, you are pooling risk just like you are with an income annuity. There's no difference between them. And I think that a lot of people, even if they don't like annuitization, we're forced to do so for one simple reason. If you want to squeeze a maximum income out of your retirement savings, one of the ways you can do that is by turning around and using some of your savings to buy an immediate annuity.
Let's talk about another concept that we're starting to see, and I've seen some recent surveys in the Wall Street Journal talking about this. What about, Jonathan, the idea of working longer?
I think that's a great idea, Jim. I mean, if you can work longer, you have a bunch of financial levers that you're pulling to your advantage. One, you've got longer to save. Two, you have longer for your assets to grow. Three, you postpone the point at which you start drawing down your assets. And because when you retire, you're older, if you turn around and you buy an income annuity or you turn around and you claim Social Security at that juncture, you're going to get a larger benefit because you are older and because the length of your expected retirement is now shorter. And just as sort of an added point, you know, one of the things that I see a lot, and I suspect, you know, you see as well, Jim, is a lot of people struggle in retirement. They think it's going to be like a long vacation and they're going to be so happy just sitting around relaxing day after day. We are not built to relax. We are built to go out and achieve goals, you need a sense of purpose to your retirement. And working a couple of days a week in retirement so you get in some extra income can have the added bonus of giving a sense of purpose to your retirement, and that can make for a much happier retiree.
You know, what you're really talking about is developing some preset strategies ahead of time, because I think what happens sometimes, Jonathan, and we saw this during the financial crisis, a lot of people might have been in their late 50s thinking, oh, okay, I'm going to work to age 65, 66, and all of a sudden the financial crisis comes along, they get laid off, and all of a sudden they're thrust into retirement, they're making bad decisions on taking Social Security early, and they don't have the choices. So don't you think it's really important, I don't care if you're 50, 55, but have sort of a plan, or let's say a plan B, so to speak, just in case of either one, health reasons come along, or two, economic reasons come along, and you find yourself in retirement earlier than you expected?
No, I think that's a great point. And, you know, you should start to think about what you will do in that scenario if you are pushed into retirement earlier than you expect. And as I mentioned, you know, people tend to end up retiring 3 years earlier than they plan. So a lot of people are ending up with this unexpected retirement, and you need to figure out how you're going to get through that period. And coming back to your point about working, you know, if you can somehow find a way to continue to work for a few more years, even if it's on a part-time basis, even if it's as a consultant or as a freelancer, that could be a great way to bridge the gap between losing your full-time position and moving to the point where you're fully retired.
And when you talk about all these things, having a plan, you know, we talked about a couple of things, just the various options that an individual has with Social Security. For example, in many cases, let's say the husband was the main breadwinner, you know, it might be a strategy where he either files and suspends, he files for his Social Security, but suspends it, allows it to grow, gives his wife half of it. She could take his half and allow hers to grow when she gets to full retirement age. There's so many things that you can do that can extend that, build your own pension. But you know what it does? It takes having the time to do a plan, because without a plan, how do you know what life's unexpectancies are going to be?
Go back 15 years, 20 years. When I used to talk to financial planners, most of them were of the opinion, oh, just claim Social Security early and, you know, we'll take care of the rest. Since then, there have been numerous books that have come out about the best strategies for claiming Social Security. There are a number of financial advisors out there who have made a specialty of figuring out when to claim Social Security. If you're not going to take the time to research this yourself, it's really worthwhile hiring somebody, a financial planner or financial advisor who's knowledgeable about this area, to guide you on when to claim Social Security, because it really is a crucial choice. And there are a variety of strategies you can use that can really dramatically increase the benefit that you and your spouse receive.
You know, something that you've written about, we've talked about it here on the program, but, you know, let's talk about one of the reasons that people are pinching pennies. One of them is rising life expectancies. And we know that, you know, the expenses of retirement, Jonathan, maybe in the early years of retirement, it might be traveling. You're spending a lot more on traveling. But in the latter years of retirement, a lot of that is going to come in the form of medical expenses. I read a figure, a husband and wife age 65 could plan on shelling out close to $250,000 out of their own pockets for medical care during their lifetime. And that's not counting long-term care. Let's talk about dividend stocks for retirement income as an inflation hedge and making sure you don't run out of money. Because typically when somebody retires, they think, okay, safety. They're putting a lot of their money in fixed income, CDs and treasuries, which was a great deal 15 years ago when rates were higher, but certainly a lot more difficult today and not as attractive when you have interest rates close to zero.
Yeah, no, I've come to believe, and I've written about this, that buying dividend stocks can be a better alternative to buying bonds if you want income. And a lot of people will hear me say that and go, oh boy, the stock market is so risky. Don't you remember what happened back in 2008? From peak to trough, we saw the market drop 57%. I'm just not willing to put large amounts of money into stocks. And what I respond is, well, let's build a strategy where you don't have to worry about selling stocks. One of the great things about stocks is not only do the share prices tend to go up over time, but there are a lot of bumps along the way, but also if you buy a broadly diversified collection of dividend-paying stocks, that stream of dividends will tend to rise over time. And not only will it rise, it will rise faster than inflation. Historically, the dividends on the S&P 500 have risen about 1.5 percentage points a year faster than inflation. So if we get 2% inflation a year going forward, and you own a collection of dividend-paying stocks, you might see your dividends rise by 3.5% a year. So today, you could probably go out and buy a collection of blue-chip stocks, or you go out and buy a high-dividend fund and get a yield of around 3%. That's going to be better than you can get in treasuries. And then going forward, not only will you get that 3% a year, but you can actually have a reasonable expectation that dividend yield, that dividend stream will rise faster than inflation over time. So if you're looking for income, forget what the share price. If you're looking for income, collection of high dividend stocks is a pretty attractive proposition.
At least this is the first time in my career, which spans over three decades, Jonathan, where you can actually find stocks that have higher yields than bonds. Typically, bonds always had a higher yield than what you could get in stocks. But today, I don't care if you're talking about blue chip stocks, Coca-Cola, a Procter & Gamble, a Johnson & Johnson, you can get yields of 3% when we have treasury yields less than 2.5%.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary development. I mean, for people who want a history lesson, you go back to the late 1950s. Up until that point, you know, stocks were expected to yield more than bonds. And at that point, it was around 1958, the dividend yields of stocks dropped below the dividend yield on government bonds, and people were absolutely sure the market was going to collapse. This was the sell signal. Well, instead, you know, we had a great run from stocks from there, right up until the financial crisis, and then at that point, stocks started to yield more than bonds, and they continue to do so for the last half dozen years. And I think that's really an indication that stocks are indeed a better value than bonds.
So when you take the number of things that we talked about, you know, optimizing your Social Security benefits, number one, creating maybe a defined benefit pension plan through an immediate annuity so you can't outlive your income, working a little bit longer, or even adding some dividend-paying stocks. The point that I think you're trying to make here, and I guess we're making here on the program today, Jonathan, is you don't have to pinch pennies. There are options that are available to the average retiree. They just need to maybe sit down and do some little planning and think this through.
I totally agree with you, but I think also one of the points that I hope is coming through loud and clear here is that it's not just one strategy. There isn't a single investment product out there that's going to solve all of your retirement problems. Instead, what you want to do is put together a variety of strategies. Use part of your savings early on so you can delay Social Security. Annuitize part of your money. Put part of your money into dividend-paying stocks. And yeah, you know, also have some money in bonds. But what you want to do is create a variety of pools of money that achieve different goals and provide you with different streams of income so that you're going to do reasonably well no matter what happens in the financial market.
And this is something I think that's a very important point to stress here, because what we saw coming out of the financial crisis is a lot of individuals went to almost one side of the boat and they went into bond funds. We know, for example, in this bull market, the public has not been as great a participant in this stock market, bull market that began in 2009, as in previous markets.
And it's such a shame. You know, go back to early 2009, and, you know, I believe that that was the buying opportunity for our generation. And instead of buying, a lot of people at that point were selling, and they were selling stocks and locking in losses and saying goodbye to money that they will never see again. And it's only now, half a dozen years later, with the S&P 500 up well over 200%, that people are finally starting to show some interest in stocks. And frankly, you know, it's a little late. It's not too late. I mean, stocks are expensive, but, you know, they're probably still a decent investment for the long haul. But, you know, it's such a shame that people weren't buying half a dozen years ago.
You know, you've been covering the retirement market and writing about it in your columns for quite some time. What would you say in your coverage of retirement, what have been, in your opinion, some of the biggest mistakes that retirees have made?
I think we've covered some of them here. I mean, one of them is taking Social Security at age 62 rather than looking into the best strategy for maximizing benefits. Two, you know, I've heard from many retirees over the years who have looked at their portfolios, thought that they had enough money, resigned, and then half a dozen years later discovered they simply didn't have enough assets to carry them through a long retirement. And that problem really occurred not just because they didn't retire with enough money, but also they retired with the illusion that they could pull far more out of their portfolios than they really could. I don't know if you remember, Jim, but you go back to the 1990s, and people would talk about 6 or 8 or even 10% as a reasonable withdrawal rate on a portfolio. And those withdrawal rates might have seemed reasonable given the high stock returns we saw in the late 1990s, but they weren't reasonable if you look at the long sweep of market history. You know, these days, you know, if you're simply drawing down a portfolio, you know, that 4% withdrawal rate seems like it's still a pretty good rule of thumb.
I mean, I can remember, heck, and you go back to 2000, I could get 5, 6, 7% in treasury bills, or heck, you were getting that in money market funds. So, you know, those kind of returns when people were think of 10%, well, if you were getting 6 and 7% in T-bills, it probably wasn't unrealistic to think of getting 10% out of, let's say, a market-based return, but those days are gone. So tell us a bit as we close. You've recently written a new book. Tell our listeners about that book and what it's about.
I wrapped up at the end of last year a book called The Jonathan Clements Money Guide 2015. It's an annually updated personal finance guide. I'll be putting out another edition in early 2016. What's unique about this book is not only does it cover pretty much every financial topic conceivable, including the topics that we discussed here on the show, but also what I do is I wrap up that book as of December 31st, with the latest numbers on the economy, the latest numbers on the markets, the latest tax rates, and then it's available the next day through Amazon, January 1, and I will be doing that again at the end of this year, and it'll be available, the 2016 edition, on January 1, 2016.
Well, Jonathan, outside your book, how can our listeners follow the work that you do?
You can check my personal website. It's jonathanclements.com. You can follow me on Facebook at Jonathan Clements Money Guide. And I'm also on Twitter, at Clements Money. My column appears Saturday in the Wall Street Journal and on WSJ.com, and it's available for free on MarketWatch.com every Monday.
Well, listen, Jonathan, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Some great stuff. And hopefully, you know, the message here is there is no one panacea for all of your retirement needs. But with a little planning and some options and diversification, multiple things can happen and you can live stress-free throughout retirement. Jonathan, thanks for joining us on the program.
It's been my pleasure.
You know, Jim, perhaps the most important comment that he made here is that when you're doing this type of planning, one particular asset class doesn't just work by itself. There's got to be some diversity in what you're doing. And what happened at the bottom of the market when we saw the crash, as we all know that a lot of people always make very classic mistakes, but people got out of a lot of things and just went into a few things like bonds or, say, metals or something like that. And that won't do it. You have to be spread across various assets.
And it really is, because I could see putting money in bonds. You want some money for stability, something you don't worry about. But one of the biggest things that we've seen is this is probably the most hated bull market in history. People just didn't want to be in stocks after the financial crisis, but the damage had already been done. The point that Jonathan was trying to make in that interview is, look, there is no perfect investment out there. It's not stocks. It's not bonds. It's not an annuity. They all fit in together. The important point is to create a diversified portfolio with each asset class providing a particular need that when you combine them all together is what brings you that security in retirement. And unfortunately, John, it's something that has gone unheeded in retirement. And I think that's why, according to the latest study that they talked about, that we began the interview, the National Retirement Risk Index created by Boston's College Center for Retirement Research said that 52% of households will now see their standards of living fall if they opt to retire at age 65. And that's up from 30% in 1989. I think it's a lot of poor decisions that are being made and the lack of planning, unfortunately. The good news is with some proper planning and diversification, a lot of these problems can be resolved. Well, we've run out of time again, as we always do. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Lifetime Income Program. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.